Please a warm welcome for Senator Gary Peters.
Well, thank you, Mark, for that warm introduction. And Steve, thank you for your leadership of this great club. It is truly an honor to be here and have an opportunity to say a few words. And I'm particularly excited about the Q&A to follow. I know Mark is ready for some tough ones that he's been making up, but also looking forward to yours as well. You know, Michigan has had a long history as an innovator. At the dawn of the 20th century, Michigan's transformed the way the world was going to work for the next century with the development of the automobile and the facilities associated with the assembly line. And what I think is particularly exciting is that now, at the dawn of the 21st century, with the advent of self-driving automobiles, Michigan is once again positioned to transform the world. And I would say that these technologies of self-driving cars are every bit as transformational as when that first car came off of the assembly line at the beginning of the last century. Not only will self-driving cars completely change the way that we get around in the future, they also will save literally tens of thousands of lives. Today, 94% of all auto accidents are caused by human error. And self-driving technologies hold the promise to dramatically reduce that. And when you consider the fact that nearly 40,000 people die on our highways every year, that's a big deal. Hundreds of thousands of tragic injuries as well. But beyond their life-saving potential, self-driving vehicles will also unleash new mobility, options that were previously unavailable to underserved populations. In fact, just a few days ago, I had a group from the National Federation of the Blind visit my office in Washington. And the first thing they said as I walked in was that they were excited about the promise of self-driving cars, because it's going to increase their mobility and change their lives in ways that they can't fully imagine. These are some of the reasons why I've been working on a bipartisan effort in the U.S. Senate, along with Republican Commerce Committee Chairman John Thune of South Dakota. I may be new to the Senate, but I know it's always good to deal with the chairman of the committee. That's always a good way to move your legislation forward. The bill has already passed out of committee and now awaits full action from the United States Senate. And it'll update the federal rules concerning vehicle safety standards. These standards were written years before anybody thought that a self-driving car was even practical. So as a result of that, all of the federal regulations in place today basically assume that there is a human being actually operating the vehicle. So you have to have things like a steering wheel. You have to have things like a brake pedal and a long list of regulations associated with both of those. But a self-driving vehicle will not have either. It won't have a steering wheel, it won't have a brake pedal, and unless we change the regulations and create a space, we're going to be hindering the innovation to allow this technology to move forward. The bill also recognizes the incredible threat posed by cybersecurity and also consumer protections for these vehicles. And it encourages manufacturers to make these a priority as they are building these vehicles before they get out onto the road. This is obviously absolutely critical. A cyber attack, of course, is always bad. And if someone hacks into your bank account, you are very angry about that. If they steal your money, you are mad. If someone hacks into your car and drives you into a wall, that would be existential, certainly much more serious. But luckily, we are on the verge of some incredibly exciting new breakthroughs in cybersecurity, from quantum computing to the work being done by DARPA. DARPA is the Department of Defense research agency that actually brought us the internet in the first place. I serve on a subcommittee of emerging threats and capabilities, and I recently had an in-depth meeting with the folks at DARPA who are conducting some cutting-edge research into cybersecurity, and they're looking at ways that we can actually harden the machines themselves and looking at very unconventional ways of hardening them, so that you don't need to use software and constant updates in software to harden your systems. And some people are good at updating, some people aren't. They want to avoid all of that with some pretty eye-popping new technologies. And finally, we must also facilitate consumer adoption of these technologies. That means making sure that the consumers really fully understand what the capabilities of these vehicles are and what they are not. So while self-driving cars will yield tremendous benefits, they are also the proving ground for a whole new technological landscape. In fact, on a recent visit to a major tech company in Silicon Valley, I was told that these folks basically believe that self-driving cars represents the moonshot for artificial intelligence. Once we reach the point where a car's computer can successfully navigate that vehicle through a very complex city environment, AI will be ready to transform every single industry you can possibly think of. Now, economists often talk of disruptive technology and the disruptive potential of this technology. In my mind, change is only disruptive if it's happening to you. If you are leading the change, it becomes transformational. Self-driving vehicles and artificial intelligence have the potential to completely transform Michigan, but only if we lead in this technological shift. In the U.S. Senate, I'm working to ensure that Michigan leads this revolution, starting with certainly self-driving vehicles. And if we can harness this opportunity, we will also become the center for artificial intelligence here in Michigan. It will be from healthcare to aerospace to additive manufacturing. All of that will be centered through systems of AI. Michigan's growing defense industry is already leveraging our state's potential. We are a technological leader, and many of our companies are using their precision engineering to make world-class cars and trucks, but they also have expanded into defense manufacturing and, in particular, aerospace. Today, Michigan companies are engineering and manufacturing components for the highly and lethal Stryker and Bradley fighting vehicles, as well as a company I recently visited that's building components for NASA's SLS Orion spacecraft that will carry humans back to the moon in about 3 years, and if all goes according to plan, in about 15 years, we'll take humans to Mars. Our state is the home to assets like U.S. Army's Tank and Automotive Research Development Center, and they are working on some incredible technologies, including self-driving technologies. It's important to note that in Iraq, most of our nation's casualties were not sustained in direct combat actions, but rather in logistics operations, transporting fuel and other critical assets to the soldiers and the Marines on the front. Driving a fuel truck on a road with IEDs is not a safe thing to do, and many casualties result. And looking into the future, Michigan will be in a position to save those war fighters' lives. But autonomy will not only revolutionize transportation. For better or for worse, it's going to completely transform the future of warfare itself. So for example, the new F-35 fighter jet that's being deployed across the globe may very well be the last fighter jet ever produced that will have a human pilot in it. Future air battles and air-to-combat operations will likely be conducted by swarms of autonomous flying vehicles. A little food for thought for you here today as to what that would look like, the change. AI and autonomous systems will reshape our daily life. When coupled with people, machines utilizing AI will yield better results, they'll increase productivity and generate tremendous economic growth. And these applications will extend far beyond manufacturing to every facet of our lives. Exciting, just groundbreaking new technologies are advancing in gene editing and CRISPR technology, synthetic biology. These types of innovations will soon give us the power to conquer diseases that we never thought possible. The potential applications for all of these technologies is clearly limitless. And that's why Michigan is in a steep and very competitive national and international competition to create this environment. During the last major technological shift, we experienced the rise of computerization and the rise of Silicon Valley. But in the race to build self-driving cars, Michigan must and will assert itself. During a meeting with another major Silicon Valley company that I had recently, they told me that they are really creating all these incredible new machine learning systems and AI systems, and they thought, we're doing that. Maybe we should just build cars too. We're doing this, why not? And then they said they went to Detroit. They went to Detroit and they went to an auto plant and they said, wow, this is a pretty complicated business. I don't think we are going to do that. Let's leave that to the good folks in Detroit and the auto companies. Let's partner with them, and certainly we are partnering with them as well. We need to keep this momentum going, and we have the opportunity to bring even more of those companies that are already now moving into the Detroit area from Waymo to NVIDIA and a long list. But other cities are also trying to capture this momentum as well. Cities like Pittsburgh, with its nexus of robotics and expertise. We also have to look at Austin, Texas, with its culture of startups and innovation. They are also competing with us for leadership in this area. We just saw how stiff the competition is recently with the selection of Amazon's HQ2. Detroit, unfortunately, didn't make it into the top 20, and I think this should just further underscore that we cannot and will not rest on our historical position as a leader. The status quo is changing, it is changing dramatically, and we need to continue to push forward aggressively. If we're going to keep Michigan at the forefront of the technological future, we must develop and retain highly skilled talent. There is an absolute, in my mind, a shocking disconnect between 20th century education systems and where the 21st century educational needs are. We have leaders here today, but we have to do so much more. American students are falling behind our international competitors in math and science, which are critical to building that future. And we must have training for lifelong learners in science, technology, and engineering. And I may add that government can't do this alone. We need the help of everybody in this room. It's up to Michigan companies need to be part of that solution to recruit the talent that we need and train the talent from not just around the country, but around the world as well that will come to our great state. We know increased automation will significantly change the way we work, and some tasks will no longer be done by humans. We've seen shifts in employment at the hands of technological advances before. We all know 100 years ago, about 40% of people worked in agriculture. That labor force today is about 1%. And although tractors and combines reduced demand for agricultural workers, they also led to greater productivity and lower prices. And though fewer workers were needed for those jobs, we didn't see massive rates of unemployment. We saw instead growing industries and new jobs that no one ever thought of before. Now that we're moving towards a future built on machine learning and artificial intelligence, this change, I believe, will have a similar impact on jobs. And while new jobs will be created, and in the long run, they'll likely be centered in regions that are leading that transformation. So just as Silicon Valley was the one that altered the landscape of the future through their AI and IT innovations, I believe the leader of AI revolution will be the center of future gains again, and I believe that Michigan has an outstanding opportunity to be at the center of that. As new jobs are created, we must ensure that they are also sustainable, good-paying occupations that will strengthen our middle class, and not low-wage jobs that will exacerbate economic inequalities in our country. Some experts predict that today's middle class jobs are the ones most likely to be automated. This could very well lead to a hollowing out of our middle class. Workers of the future could end up in one of two tiers of jobs, working in the high wage creative positions or at lower wage jobs. And I believe this may very well require a whole new ordering, a whole new paradigm as to how we organize our society. It's important to note that today's most human of jobs, the ones that we'd be most reluctant to turn over to a robot or an AI system, are also often some of the jobs that pay the lowest amount of money to folks. For example, the caregivers who nurture our children and aid the elderly in their last years of life do important, essential human work. And I would argue that it is our responsibility as a great nation to ensure that people at the top aren't the only ones who benefit from the increased productivity that the AI revolution promises. We need to have an economy that values these most human of jobs and celebrates the superiority of human emotional intelligence over artificial intelligence. Our democracy is built on strong, vibrant, middle class, and if this technological transformation increases economic inequality, it will have an enormous impact, not just on our economy, but on our government, and quite frankly, on our democracy. We can anticipate these challenges, and we must start working now to meet them. We need to plan for not only how we will train new workers, but how we will retrain or aid workers impacted by technological shift. We also have to prepare for how artificial intelligence will change the way that we do business. Will major corporations that can amass resources and hire the best talent make it increasingly harder for small businesses to compete? We're already beginning to see glimpses of this trend, and economists are recognizing that economic concentration is a contribution to the decrease in new business formation that we have seen over the last few decades. Amazon was used as an example in a recent committee hearing that I had in the Commerce Committee of a company that's leading AI development and becoming one of the fastest growing companies in the world because of its early mastery of artificial intelligence systems. It is easy to see how Amazon will be able to integrate machine learning into their business model, but small business retailers likely won't have the capital to compete. Companies like Amazon will have a significant competitive advantage, and they represent an example of how the combination of capital with artificial intelligence system is the most powerful combination we may have seen transforming an economy in human history. This dynamic change will also lead to businesses becoming more concentrated in urban areas, accelerating the already deep economic divide between our rural and urban economies. We need to start answering these questions today so that we can ensure that the economy of the future is one that everybody has the opportunity to compete and to succeed. Thinking back, the agricultural revolution, over the course of a few centuries, transformed nomadic hunter-gatherers into farmers and city dwellers. Over the course then of 150 years, the Industrial Revolution generated equally immense technological, economic, and social changes that we enjoy today as we're sitting here in this wonderful facility. But the AI revolution and what we're seeing in advances and all the technology, some of which I mentioned, promised the same level of transformation, but it'll likely be compressed into a time of 20 or 30 years, not 150 or centuries. And while the Industrial Revolution brought tremendous economic and societal benefits, we also have to remember there was a dark side to it as well, from labor strife to two world wars that took millions of lives as a result, in some ways, of technological changes, and gave rise to toxic political ideologies like fascism. Our country has seen dramatic transformational shifts before, and we have always risen to the challenge, harnessing change to make our great country stronger. We have the chance to do that once again, but we must heed the lessons of the past, anticipate the road ahead, and craft solutions that will ensure the future is brighter than ever before. This is an incredibly exciting time in human history. In fact, I might argue it may be the most exciting time in human history to live. The future holds boundless promise, but we have to lay that groundwork for the future today. In Washington, I'm working to encourage innovation and certainly working to make sure Michigan is at the forefront of the next big thing. The transition will not be easy, and it certainly will not be smooth. But the people in this room today, each and every one of you, are really in an incredibly unique position to help guide Michigan through this revolution. I look forward to working with all of you to navigate the challenges that we face together and create a country where every American, no matter who they are, no matter where they live, they can achieve their version of the American dream. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
I got it. Senator, thank you. Before I jump into the questions, I have one comment and one request. First, I think on behalf of all the people here and all the people of the state of Michigan, We owe you and Colleen and your entire family a great debt of gratitude for how hard your work. I've seen you a number of times on that late Thursday flight back from Reagan, and it's obvious how hard your work, and for all of us, we'd like to say thank you for your service. And then I have a request. I actually have two humans I'd like to actually be on Mars. Can I get them on the list? No, okay. The first question is about talent and how that relates to immigration. Obviously, there's a big conversation in this country, as there have been for many years, about immigration. Can you give us your sense as to where we're headed on the immigration question and how important that is with regards to talent, innovation, and positioning Michigan for the future?
Well, it is incredibly important, and the immigration debate to me is twofold. One, we've got to deal with border security, which will be part of any immigration bill that comes out, and we've got to do that in a thoughtful way, and being on a northern border, we understand it's not just about the southern border, but also the northern border as well. But we also have to have a road for the best and brightest to come to this country, as they always have had in this country. We are a nation of immigrants. We all came from somewhere else. My mother was a French citizen and now a very proud naturalized citizen. My father met her during the Second World War. He was a soldier in Europe and met this beautiful French woman and married her, and that's my mom. Every family has stories of people coming to this country. In fact, if you look at new business development, if you look at innovation, most of the new companies that are formed are from immigrants or the first generation of immigrants. The vast majority of that dynamism exists because people come from all over the world seeking out that American dream that they want to pursue. So we need to continue to do that. The immediate debate that we have right now before the U.S. Senate deals with a program dealing with Dreamers or DACA program, which I think most of you are familiar with the debate now. To me, this is an issue that has wide agreement in the country. In fact, I think 80% of the American people believe that we need to have a path for DACA. And if I may, I'm just going to give one story of a young woman who I've been working to help as an example of that DACA kid. She was a young woman who came to this country as a child. She was 5 years old. Her mother is Albanian. She came from Albania. She grew up her whole life in America. She doesn't speak Albanian. She's never been to Albania. She graduated as valedictorian of her high school. She was accepted to the University of Michigan in their advanced medical program. And the U.S. government wants to deport her back to a country that she's never been to and doesn't speak the language. This is a woman who would contribute so much to the vitality of this great country of ours. And her story can be told by many, many other students and DACA kids. Many of them are serving in the United States military and may find themselves not being able to stay in this country. So we hope to have a bipartisan solution. Hopefully, if not this week, we have a commitment from the Majority Leader McConnell to go to the floor and to be able to debate this issue, to put amendments forward, to have a robust kind of dialogue, which you would expect and hope the United States Senate could do as a deliberative body, and hopefully be able to come out with broad bipartisan support out of the Senate. I will say, it's not only my Democratic caucus. I have many friends in the Republican caucus who genuinely want to get this done too, so I am cautiously optimistic we'll be able to come together to be able to pass a bill that'll deal with both Dreamers, giving them a path, as well as dealing with border security, and in a way that makes sense, that's based on actual reasons and not political reasons.
Senator, you mentioned the Amazon HQ2 bid, and yes, heartbreaking that we weren't in the top 20 list, but also probably instructive about lessons learned. What would you grab from that experience for the state of Michigan?
Well, I think there are a number, and all others have been talking about it. Certainly a trained workforce, which I mentioned, is important to make sure that you have those workers to do it. Also, some of the aspects that came out was a transit system as well, to be able to move people regionally. When you look at all those creative, and where do creative people want to live? They want to have transit systems. Transit systems, however, may change pretty dramatically with self-driving automobiles. That would be a different answer to that question, that I think you're going to see the landscape change. So I think as we look at this future, how do we design the urban spaces that are going to capture all of the exciting things that are happening? And that means a connected city that connects with vehicles, connects with people's homes, connects in a broad way that makes this place just as exciting as a Seattle or a San Francisco Francisco or some other cities. There's no reason whatsoever that we're not there. I believe Detroit is at this verge of this incredibly dynamic place that we're at right now. But this also shows that other places are a little bit ahead of us. We have every way to get ahead of them, and particularly when we seize this AI stuff related to autonomous cars, that we'll be able to be the winner in the future. But this should not, we should not sit back and be depressed in any way. If anything, we should use this as a call to action. We know what the roadmap is. We know what the plan. We have great universities. We have great entrepreneurs. A statistic that I love to tell to my colleagues in Washington, D.C., we have more engineers, Doctor, we have more engineers per capita in the greater Detroit area than any other region of the country. The intellectual capital that's sitting in this room and is in this city and is in this region is unparalleled. We just have to harness it all to go forward, and I'm confident of our future.
I have a question from our students. You've dedicated so much of your adult life to public service. What advice would you give to those who are here, especially our students who might be thinking about public service as a direction?
Well, my advice is always seek out public service in some capacity. I've found it to be very fulfilling. I spent most of my life in the private sector and worked for firms like Merrill Lynch and Payne Webber and UBS in the financial service sector, and found that very rewarding and loved being a business person. But also believe that as you are engaged in your business activities, understand that we're all part of a broader community. And some of the tough issues that we face as a society, some of the ones that I mentioned in my comments here today, they can only be solved if we do that collectively. No one individual can do it. And public service and government has a place as that convener where you bring outstanding minds together, folks in the business community, folks in the academic community, folks who care about creating a governmental system that is able to bridge the divides that divide too many of us. That only can happen through public service and people who are committed to do it. And so I would certainly hope anybody, as you're looking at your career going forward, be successful in whatever you do, but also give back to the community, and public service is a way that we hope that you choose. And unfortunately, a lot of young people get turned off by the political process, and I can understand that, because looking at the political process right now, it doesn't look real appealing. It doesn't look real appealing when you're in the process, let alone when you're looking at it from the outside. It is tough to try to find that common ground, but you can make that difference. One person can make that difference, and it won't change. If you're frustrated with what you see and you want to have it change, it will not change unless you actually get engaged yourself, and you can make that difference.
So a question on artificial intelligence. In 1942, Isaac Asimov wrote a short story in which he depicted the three laws with regards to how humans and robots should live together. And of course, that was made famous in the Will Smith movie, I, Robot. Are we thinking about that topic, and should we be thinking about those three laws and whether or not they should be really part of law as we move forward on AI?
Yes, one of them is do no harm to humans is one of those laws, which is a really good law to have, a very important one. I'm in favor of that law. Hopefully we have 100% agreement in the room on that one. And that raises a very important question, though, is that we do have to think about the moral, ethical issues associated with this incredibly powerful technology. Now, we're still a ways off from what they call general AI, which is human-type thinking, but it may happen a whole lot quicker than people realize. And first, let me drench the speed and then talk about some of the moral ethical issues. Some of you may have seen that a computer beat, or an AI system beat, the game of Go. And this is pretty instructive to me as to what that really means. You know, computers have been able to beat chess masters for quite some time. And part of that is that there's a finite, although there's a lot of moves, there's a finite number of moves on a chessboard, and a computer can just crunch through that faster than any human mind can do that, so it beats the chess master. But then there's this game called Go, which I don't really know how to play. It's a very popular Asian game. It is considered the most human of possible games you can play. Apparently all of the combinations of the game are equal to all of the grains of sand on the earth. That's a lot of combinations, and it really requires a human mind to be creative and to think it through. And folks thought a machine would never be able to beat a master of Go for a minimum of 10 years, but probably 15 years before they would advance. Well, this last year, around in the fall, I believe in the fall of last year, a system by Google beat the Chinese master of Go, fully 15 years before anybody thought that was possible. The Chinese never thought it was possible. They had it on live TV because they said, this American machine is going against a Chinese master. We think we know who's going to win that game. But actually, the machine started beating the master, and then the Chinese had technical difficulties and the screen went down. I'm not sure if that was a coincidence or not. Probably not a coincidence. But the game won over and over again. And the fascinating thing, in talking to some cyber experts about that, they said, you know, the most interesting thing about this, Senator, is that we're not really sure how the machine actually did that. Well, that's enough to get me a little concerned when I hear that. It is amazing with these neural networks that are being created and how to really trace how those algorithms and networks are working together, which means that we have to be looking at the moral and ethical implications of this. In the past, we would worry about that stuff after technology came out, but as I mentioned in my comments, we had time. New technology comes out, it may take a decade before it really has impact. It may take longer than that. We are not going to have that time now. We have to be thinking about this stuff now. In fact, some of the researchers look at AI systems and they believe that they create biases with some of the initial programming. Significant biases are created as a result of the system, and then it makes decisions, and those decisions are based on those biases. But we have to work through that and understand how these machines are working, how do we deal with those biases, what are the moral ethical implications. One in particular that I'm engaged in too, I mentioned the changing face of warfare. When you think about autonomous weapon systems, drones, as I mentioned, swarms of drones. You know, already we have wide use of drones today. In fact, in Michigan, we have a National Guard unit that flies autonomous, or not autonomous, they're pilots. They fly drones in Afghanistan. In fact, as we speak here today, they are flying drones in Afghanistan, but they're sitting in a room in Battle Creek, Michigan, flying those weapons. It's pretty amazing. And at some point, you may take the human pilot out of those systems as well. And as someone who studied philosophy, the moral and ethical issues of autonomous weapon systems that are able to instantly target, acquire a target and fire, is a frightening proposition that as a world we better start thinking through now before it changes everything we know.
So Senator, you mentioned the American Center for Mobility during your comments. In late 2016, the federal government anointed 10 centers for testing and certification of autonomous vehicles, ACM being one of those 10. Those on the front lines believe that 10 is probably not the right number. It'll get consolidated over time to a much smaller number. What do we in Michigan have to do to make sure that we're a survivor in that discussion?
Yes, we work very aggressively to get these national designations, which will really create a testing validation site that NHTSA will use to figure out whether or not this technology is ready to be put out on the roads. We were arguing aggressively that 10 is too big a number. It should have only been one, and it should have been in Ypsilanti, Michigan. But unfortunately, I have to deal with other senators from other states, and for some reason, they think their state's got more going than we do. So the compromise was 10, and so we got down to 10. But I think we have a significant competitive advantage with those 10, because what's going to happen is you've got to be paired with academic resources. We have ones. We've got Lawrence Tech. You've got the University of Michigan that's hosting the site. You've got Michigan State, Wayne State. All of these universities are working with some very cutting-edge technologies that will be tested on that site. We already have research and development, not just for Ford and for General Motors, but Toyota's in Ann Arbor, Nissan's in Farmington Hills, Honda is across the border in Ohio. That and the engineering talent that I mentioned is all here that makes this site, I think, the preeminent site where you're going to see everybody coming to test. And that's important because where folks come to test, and these test tracks are different than a traditional test track for an auto company. You know, right now, an auto company will have a test track where they only have their products, and they hide them from everybody else because there's competitive reasons for that, and you want to be able to develop a new product that will capture market share. The problem with autonomous vehicles and self-driving cars is they all have to be connected. For part of these systems to work, they all have to talk to each other. So you got to have them on a test site where a Toyota is talking to a Ford and a Ford to a GM and to a Nissan. So they all got to be in one place. And the fact we already have that critical mass and we're going to have this state-of-the-art track here that has some features. For example, one of the features on it is the first the triple overpass in America is located on that site. You know, triple where you got a highway and a bridge and another bridge, three of them. We need to be able to navigate through those triple overpasses. If you were to build a test site with that, it's incredibly expensive. We already have it. The other great advantage that we have here in Michigan, and we know it today, we have snow and ice. That is a huge advantage when it comes to this. And I'm pretty excited because You know, they have a test track in California. They don't have snow and ice there. I'm sorry. You know, if you can drive a car in 80-degree weather and sun, that's not the real world. Let's face it. We have the real world here. And in addition to that ice and snow, we've got some great potholes. And those potholes, you better drive around those potholes. And so put all that together, we've got to be the number one site.
Awesome. So a question on cyber. During lunch we were talking about last week I was in Israel as part of the Michigan-Israel Business Accelerator with the governor's CIO and General Vadnais. 10,000 people gathered from all over the world to talk about cyber. How do we create international partnerships so that some of the most innovative technology and thinking from around the world will think of Michigan as a beachhead for taking their technology and integrating it with industry?
Well, part of that, you mentioned the Israelis are, with no question, some of the absolute leaders when it comes to the cyber technology. The efforts that you're involved and others of really creating partnerships with Israeli companies here in the United States with our defense sector that is always already very, very strong puts us at a great position. We have some universities here locally, too, that are stepping up their education of cyber professionals, which allows us to grow that together. But I'll tell you one area that I'll mention this kind of taking from that question, it's important, and another one that I'm working on with another one of my Republican colleagues, Senator Cornyn, who is, and the two of us have been working for quite some months now, dealing with keeping some of the intellectual property among friends, let's put it that way. And as new companies are starting to sprout up, a lot of these innovative ideas are not generated by large companies. They tend to be a lot of small startups, many of them coming out of universities and they aren't quite ready to commercialize some of the innovation that they have. And what we're finding is that we will have potential adversaries of ours who are buying these companies. They're going in and buying that intellectual talent, basically. So I'm working with Senator Cornyn on, CFIUS is an agency that actually prevents some of those financial transactions from going forward if they could be a threat to national security. That system's been around a long time, and it's, quite frankly, it's got a lot of gaps in it, and our adversaries have figured out how to get around those gaps pretty effectively. So we are going to have major reform to make it more difficult for not friendly entities from buying those companies. And I'll just give you an example. I was recently at the University of Michigan talking to some of the folks there about it. And you know, the difference in America versus some of the other countries, because they understand some of the national security implications of this. You will have a new startup with some brilliant professor and some of his graduate students, and they got a great idea, and they figure, well, I'm going to start a company. But these folks are brilliant at science and technology. They're not so schooled in the world of business. And so, obviously, as business people, all of you here, you'll say, well, we'll be interested in buying your company, but we need to see a business plan and what are your forecasts, all the questions that you will ask before you make an investment, which is prudent. But our adversaries, I won't mention a couple, but you can think of who they are, they go, how much do you want for your company? Business plan, we don't need to see that. No, we don't care. Just how much do you want for this company? We like what you're doing here. We're just going to invest in it. And they buy the company. They buy the intellectual property as a result of that. That's a huge threat to our country, especially with technology rapidly going up. I mentioned DARPA has done some great stuff, but you know, most of the new innovations will not come from the Department of Defense. They're going to come from private companies, these small private companies, whether it's in cyber or autonomy and additive manufacturing, all these things will be critical. They're going to come from private companies, and we have to treat those private companies as a critical national security resource and do it a whole lot earlier than we ever did in the past.
So there's a term we're all familiar with. This is a student question, actually, working across the aisle. Can you tell us what your perspective is about that today and how you think that can be improved so we can move the country forward?
Well, I think that's the only way to work. I've mentioned some examples with Senator Cornyn, for example, and with our work with autonomous vehicles, et cetera. But it's a frustrating place to work because we have to find ways to bring people together. And I find in my colleagues in the Senate, you know, although we have differences in policies and the like, there are a lot that we have in common, too. And we've got to just unite around those common ideas as we go forward. I'll just give a recent incident, was when we had a government shutdown here, which I think is absolutely crazy. The government should never shut down. It's a fundamental function of Congress. And so when we got to that point, I actually got together with some of my colleagues, Susan Collins, Joe Manchin, and a group of us, and we called, this is really radical, so be prepared, it's called the Common Sense Coalition, really radical, and we said, let's get together. There were, at that point, 22 of us, there were 10 Republicans, 12 Democrats. They got together and said, let's figure out a way to get through this. Let's find common ground. Let's reopen the government. Let's try to find a path for the immigration issue that both parties can agree on, where it's narrow, and we understand it's going to be important for our country. And I hope that that coalition is a model for where we can go forward. I've had the good experience of working with some of my colleagues and some of the newer ones that I came in with, too, who want to work on these issues. When I got elected in 2014, there were 13 new U.S. senators, 12 Republicans, and me. So I was in a caucus of one. Some people thought that was a lonely position. I said, no, that's leadership. I'm president of my caucus. But the good news is I got to get to know 12 Republicans really well. We break bread together. Our spouses know each other. We're working on legislation together. That has to be the model that we do. The American people expect nothing less. And you have my commitment to be thinking about that and doing it every single day I'm in the U.S. Senate.
So, Senator, before we turn the podium back over to Steve, I have some lightning round questions for you.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Lightning round.
Okay, the first question is, the person you would like to have lunch with?
Actually, it doesn't have, alive or deceased, does it matter? The president that I've always, and this is an example of bipartisanship, the president that I've always admired more than any other president is Theodore Roosevelt. And I think he was an outstanding leader. I would love to be with Theodore Roosevelt.
Very good. One of your favorite movies?
Any of the Indiana Jones movies. I love those.
Okay, great.
How do you not, huh?
Can you describe one word that embodies the spirit of Michigan?
Dynamic, for the reasons I mentioned today.
Is it true that you're going to have this beard until the Lions win the Super Bowl?
It's possible. I will not make that commitment. Actually, the only commitment I made is when my wife tells me it goes. She sets the rules when it comes to my beard.
Okay, last question before Steve comes up. The advice you would give to your 25-year-old self?
I think I'll pick up. One of the students already asked that question. I feel really blessed to be able to serve the state of Michigan in the U.S. Senate and blessed with the opportunity to deal with some of these tough issues as a public servant. So when I was 25, I was new into the investment business. I was at Merrill Lynch and managing the office, and I actually had to kind of think about my direction of my life at that point. And I had a chance to go to New York or go to a couple other places where they wanted to send me. But I actually, in the back of my mind, always thought, I want public service to be part of my future, that I think it's so important to do that. And so I would say my advice to myself is, during those times you weren't sure of what path you were going to take, be comfortable, but the path towards public service is a good path and one that makes a difference.
Ladies and gentlemen, our Senator Gary Peters.
Senator Peters, let me echo Mark's sentiment earlier. Thank you, thank you, thank you for your Common Sense Coalition and for your service to our state of Michigan. Thank you. Mark Davidoff, great job as presiding officer. Ladies and gentlemen, this meeting is adjourned. Have a great week.